Court is ready to hear argument in 090520 N. Ray Coy Reese.
May it please the court, Mr. Gilberth will present argument for the relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Opposing counsel and I agree on one thing in this case, and that is that the court in this case does not have habeas jurisdiction. We have asked the court to exercise its mandamus jurisdiction, and we have relied almost exclusively on the court's 1960 decision in Duramus versus Thornton. In that case, I think the court presciently anticipated this very case and held that under some circumstances, when habeas relief is not available, mandamus relief will be appropriate. The court also noted, stated that in dicta, let me be more precise. The court also noted, again in dicta, that there was no jurisdictional problem with exercising mandamus jurisdiction under these circumstances. In 1995, and then again in 1997, the court then reiterated what it said in Duramus. And those cases are cited on my list of supplemental authorities, the Dunn versus Street case and the Rosser versus Squire case. In both of those cases, the court again said, look, if we don't have habeas jurisdiction, we can exercise our mandamus jurisdiction. So I think as a purely prudential matter, the notion that mandamus is appropriate when habeas is not available seems to be a sound one.
Is your motion for reconsideration still pending at the CCA?
Yes.
And how does that impact your argument that you have no adequate remedy by appeal if we still have?
That we have no adequate remedy over there?
If it's still pending. In other words, they may change their mind.
I think they've made it pretty clear in their decision, or their order rather, sending the case over here, that they don't want the case. Because the question I think that the court needs to be considering, and which I didn't fully address in my briefing, is whether anything has changed since 1960 to create a jurisdictional problem. And the answer to that question is no. As recently as 1979, this court held, and that's the third case on my list, the Grimm case, the court said, look, we have mandamus jurisdiction in criminal cases. And the court used to exercise that mandamus jurisdiction quite frequently. The only reason it doesn't do so anymore is that as of January 1978, the Court of Criminal Appeals, by constitutional amendment, was given concurrent jurisdiction to exercise mandamus jurisdiction. So in criminal cases, and that's explained in that Grimm case cited on the list. And so this court no longer needs to exercise mandamus jurisdiction in criminal law cases, although it does have the power to do so. But I think it's ultimately irrelevant that the court has mandamus jurisdiction in criminal law cases, criminal law matters, because this contempt judgment is not a criminal law matter. The Court of Criminal Appeals certainly didn't think so. It said, look, this is from a civil case. We don't have any business handling it. And the reason is that even though we call this criminal contempt, it's really a more accurate term for it is punitive contempt.
But he's asking that he be discharged from restrictions on his liberty. doesn't that look more like a habeas and not a...
It is typically addressed by habeas, and this court has the power, of course, to do so in many respects. So the court has jurisdiction to issue habeas relief, but in some instances, habeas just isn't available, and the court has taken up a number of cases like that. For example, in the Dunn case and the Rosser case on my list there, the court said, look,
we don't have...
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, if we were to grant mandamus relief here, wouldn't we just be opening ourselves up to a flood of mandamuses?
No, you wouldn't, Your Honor, for this reason. First off, this is the only case that we've been able to find where the court doesn't have habeas jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
This is a rarity. I mean, there are no cases in Texas where a person has been held in contempt for allegedly committing perjury in their deposition.
Does procedure matter at the lower court? For example, here he was found to be lying on the oath, right?
Yes.
Rather than in violation of an order that's already was in existence.
Correct.
So does that matter?
It does matter in terms of whether the court has habeas jurisdiction. The court does not because he wasn't held in contempt for violating an order. Now, this court would have habeas jurisdiction for a criminal contempt, let's say the judge, the trial judge says, I don't want you to mention insurance during your closing argument, and the lawyer goes ahead and does so, the judge then holds him in contempt and says, I'm putting you in jail for 2 days for doing that. That would be a criminal contempt, violation of a court order. This court has said an oral order is sufficient. So the court could then use its habeas jurisdiction to get that lawyer out if it felt that that was necessary. So the court has habeas jurisdiction, to answer your question, Justice Lehrman, over almost every instance except this one, which I think should tell the court something about whether this using contempt power to hold the person or to find somebody in contempt for perjury, whether that's appropriate. But I think we'll get to that in a moment. To finish up on the jurisdictional question, so I think it's comforting that this court does have mandamus jurisdiction in criminal matters, criminal contempt matters, but it's really kind of irrelevant here because this is not a criminal law matter. It's criminal contempt, but it arises out of a civil case.
Do you understand the Court of Criminal Appeals' opinion to be that while on its face the Constitution might give them broader power, they've interpreted their power consistent with ours for the last 100 years or so? Is that their position, or can you tell?
In terms of jurisdictional power, I think it'd be hard to generalize like that, Your Honor, because the Constitution has been amended a number of times. For example,
but I guess my question is the Court of Criminal Appeals' position, or can you tell, that they too do not have jurisdiction unless there's a violation of a written order?
Oh, no, I don't think they. I think they, in their order, it seems to me that they say, yes, we would have habeas jurisdiction over this. So.
Can you clarify the timeline for me? When did the CCA deny the application for writ of habeas corpus?
Well, it was shortly before we came over here. I don't remember the
date. I'm just trying to find out the exact sort of sequence.
Oh, okay. Well, we went to the Court of Appeals, and they let Mr. Reese out of jail.
Right.
The other side then said, hey, wait, you don't have jurisdiction. So then the court vacated its order. Mr. Reese went back to jail. We went to the Court of Criminal Appeals before he could be reconfined, and we said, hey, we need habeas relief. And they said, no, he's got to be in confinement. So then once he was reconfined, we went back to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and then they said, well, we think this is a civil case, and they sent it over here across the hall, or we brought it.
Well, right, you say they sent, but you filed here,
yeah.
And then you filed your motion to reconsider over there before you filed here or after you filed here?
I think we filed it, the motion to reconsider, before we filed here. I'm not certain, but I think that's the right.
And if we say the CCA was mistaken, and this case belongs across the hall, and they deny your motion for rehearing, potentially, then what?
Then I think we're done, and I think the problem with that seems to me that, I thought about this, it seems kind of third world for this court for this thing to bounce back and forth between the two courts. I mean, for this court to say, well, we could exercise our mandamus jurisdiction, we could exercise our habeas jurisdiction, but no, you guys take it, no, you guys take it. And I think that that's a good reason for this court, and as, you know, Braden has noted about the complexity of the Texas judicial system, I think it's a good reason for this court to say it is a civil case and we'll exercise our mandamus jurisdiction on this, and it's a rarity. Now we have...
Let me ask you this. So in civil matters, you're saying that the Texas Supreme Court can resolve issues that, such as this one, that have that touch on criminal issues?
The court has power to issue mandamus in criminal cases. The court used to do so quite frequently in, I think it was speedy trial cases, where a petitioner would come up and say, I need to go to trial, I want to get acquitted. And the court, until 1979, was issuing mandamuses regularly in those cases. So the court maintains jurisdiction over criminal law matters to issue mandamus. It's appellate jurisdiction. The court has no appellate jurisdiction over criminal law matters, but the court has drawn a distinction between its appellate jurisdiction and its original proceeding or mandamus jurisdiction. Now, we have argued that a party may not be held in contempt for perjury committed in a deposition, and there are three ways the court could reach that result. I think the third way is the best approach. The first approach would be to hold that, just as a matter of law, perjury cannot be contempt. We have cited on my list, I've given you a couple of cases, Missouri courts say perjury can't be contempt. New York cases also seem to reach that result. The second approach would be to hold that perjury that's committed outside the presence of a court cannot be contempt, or cannot be addressed through the court's contempt power. As this court well knows, the perjury that's committed outside the presence of a court is constructive contempt, or misbehavior outside the presence of a court is constructive contempt. And the court could hold that constructive contempt is limited to violation of court orders.
Examples, that would just encourage people to not tell the truth. They'll take an oath to tell the truth, and it doesn't mean anything because there's nothing that can be done to them.
I think there's sufficient deterrence against perjury, Your Honor, to prevent that. I don't think it would encourage it.
What would those things be? What would the deterrence be?
The threat of criminal prosecution, and I think where the justices are heading now is an issue that I'd like to address by referring the court to a concurring opinion, and this is from a case that's not cited in my brief nor on my list, by Justice Scalia in a case called Young versus United States. That's 481 U.S. 787. And that case supports why I think the third approach is the best. And let me kind of build up to that if I can. The second approach, I think, begs the question of why the court would say, well, why can't we say that perjury committed outside the court's presence is not contempt? I mean, there's no statute defining constructive contempt, so I guess you could define it that way. So I think that's why the third approach is the best approach. And that is from the United States Supreme Court's jurisprudence. In this case, and it's probably true in every case involving perjury during a deposition, there has been no obstruction of justice. That's a requirement from the United States Supreme Court's decision beginning in 1919, the Hudgings case cited and discussed in our brief. And the question then becomes, well, what is obstruction in this sense? There's not much case law on it, but I think the best guidance the court could take is from the In re Michael case, cited and discussed in our brief, a 1945 U.S. Supreme Court decision. There, the court answers this very question. A person was held in contempt for lying during grand jury testimony, and the court said, well, there was no obstreperous behavior, no failure to answer questions, no evasiveness, no contumacious behavior. All it was telling a lie. The court says that's not enough to use the contempt power, because what you need is an immediate disruption of the court's business. Courts are used to, that's their job, to sort through false and truthful testimony. So handling the problem of lies does not disrupt the immediate business of the court. So then we get to in this case, you don't have any evidence of anything other than telling a lie, which we don't condone, obviously, but whether the question here is whether it disrupted the immediate business of the court. It didn't. All it did was prevent them from getting at the truth to seek the relief they wanted. It didn't. There was no destruction of documents, for example, or evidence.
Now, your third point is that you're expounding here is that constructive contempt cannot be found unless there's a signed order?
The third point would be, and this is from the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, it has to obstruct the administration of justice. That's the third approach. And here we don't have that. Now, the last thing I think the court should consider, my running out of time, is that Scalia concurring opinion. He makes a very, very important point. He says, look, the judicial power is what is granted to the court system, not the executive power. Reaching out to prosecute crimes such as contempt of a court is exercising the executive power, not the judicial power. So it's a separation of powers problem for courts to prosecute contempts. And he says, of course, if you have contempt that causes an immediate disruption of court business, then yes, courts should have the contempt power to deal with that. It's not a perjury case, but essentially his point would be that leave perjury up to the executive branch. Let them prosecute it. It's not disrupting court business because courts are already, that's the job of a court, to sort truth from falsity.
You're framing your argument broadly in the sense that constructive contempt should be perhaps enforced by the executive branch. Are you just talking about perjury or any constructive contempt? For example, a TRR order in an urgent situation, and it's violated outside the presence of the court. Would you say that contempt there also should be left to another branch?
That is where Justice Scalia would go. And that's precisely the type of situation he was dealing with in that case. He said,
What procedure would the court have to enforce its order?
Justice Scalia would say the executive branch can handle these matters, and he would say, look, just because sometimes the executive branch doesn't always prosecute things, that's no reason to violate separation of powers. Now, I'm not saying
then how here, does a trial court enforce a TRO?
I think here in Texas, I think perhaps Scalia went a little too far on that point.
Where would you go?
In Texas, courts already have power to enforce TROs through contempt powers, and I wouldn't change that. That would be constructive contempt. So I wouldn't change that. I wouldn't go quite as far as Justice Scalia, but I think the broad outlines, the theory, the separation of powers problems that he discusses are very helpful to resolving this case.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Galbraith. The court is ready to hear argument now from the real parties in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Dennis will present argument for the real parties in interest.
May it please the court, Relator's counsel mistakes deference by the Court of Criminal Appeals for dereliction. And in fact, a case cited within their own brief, Ex Parte Morris, talks about the language is clearly too simple to be without doubt that this court doesn't have habeas jurisdiction. We don't dispute that. Mr. Galbraith said he doesn't dispute that. And not only does this court not have this jurisdiction, there's no dispute that what they have brought is habeas relief. They are seeking relief from incarceration. But what they're not, the presumption they would have this court make, which is not warranted, and I'll show you why, is that the Court of Criminal
Appeals. Excuse me, I'm sorry. What's the status of Mr. Reese now?
He's sitting in the audience, Your Honor.
He's not incarcerated.
He was released by bail by this court. He served about 4 days of his 14-day incarceration. And Your Honor, so what Relator's counsel would have this court presume is that the Court of Criminal Appeals across the hall will not act on its duty and instead has said, we have that jurisdiction, we refuse to exercise it, therefore we need to create, this court needs to create an exceptional exception to what the Constitution permits and the statute permits. And that's not warranted, and I'll point this court to Ex Parte Jones, cited in our briefing. It's a case out of the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1956, and it basically encapsulates an unwritten rule that the Court of Criminal Appeals, which has very broad habeas jurisdiction, defers to this court to decide the parameters of its own more limited habeas jurisdiction. And in Ex Parte Jones, the court says, the many questions raised appear to be civil in nature. In view of the above, we deem it appropriate to say that in the event of further application for writ of habeas corpus by relators, it goes on to say, we'll only exercise our jurisdiction if the civil courts refuse to. And later, in Ex Parte Svengros, a case not in our briefing, but found by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 1964, 384 Southwestern 2nd, 881, it encapsulates this rule and says, as a general practice, this is the Court of Criminal Appeals, where there's reason to believe that the application falls within the area of concurrent jurisdiction, the Court of Criminal Appeals will decline to act until the Supreme Court has decided whether the case comes within its restricted habeas corpus jurisdiction. So,
well, it plainly doesn't.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And the relator agrees with that.
Exactly.
Well, what are they waiting on?
Well, they're actually deferring to this court.
Why defer? Everybody agrees.
They're not making the presumption that
it's plain as day.
You
don't have to presume. It says, was there a written order? There wasn't a written order. Everybody can see that. Even the relator can see it. So I'm not sure why would they defer if they didn't think they really shouldn't do it in this case?
Well, I can't speak for why the Court of Criminal Appeals was thinking when they issued the order, other than the unwritten rule which I've described. But what the relator would have this court believe is if this court finds, as it should and must, that the Constitution doesn't grant habeas jurisdiction in this case and the government code doesn't permit this court to have jurisdiction, that if it finds, as it should, we don't have jurisdiction, the Court of Criminal Appeals won't, as it has in other cases, assert their habeas jurisdiction.
Why should we think anything else when that's what they've said, and there's, it doesn't seem to be even arguable that this court has habeas jurisdiction?
But with all due respect, Your Honor, I'd say that they haven't said that in their order. They simply said, we dismiss and we ask that you can seek your relief in the Supreme Court. The motion for rehearing being pending for a year with no action is indicative of them waiting for this court to act. I believe the petitions were filed within days of each other.
Has that court been formally sort of notified of this proceeding here? I'm sure they're aware of it, but have they been formally, has anything been filed there to make them aware of this?
Your Honor, I don't know if the relator has filed anything formal letting them know. I thought that there was a reference in that motion for rehearing, but I can't be certain of that. But here, I'll go one step further. Let's presume that, as they do, that the Court of Criminal Appeals will be derelict and will not assert their duty and would leave Mr. Reese without a remedy in the Court of Criminal Appeals. That still does not give this court constitutional or statutory jurisdiction to assert habeas in this case.
Would this court ever have mandamus jurisdiction involving a civil matter where a criminal act has occurred, such as here, perjury?
I don't exactly how to answer that question, but what I will say is this court has never exercised its jurisdiction to a mandamus jurisdiction to relieve someone from incarceration. That has never happened. In fact,
we've never had somebody incarcerated on a charge of perjury in a civil case.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I would say that out-of-court statements, we cited two cases in our brief.
Powell and Sutphin.
Exactly.
Sutphin was a fine, and Powell was dismissed for want of jurisdiction.
Sutphin was a fine, but the incarceration had already been served, I believe. And what I would say, Your Honor, is that this case is not as unique as they'd have you make it out to be. What they're asking this court to find is an exception that says, putting aside the Constitution and the enabling statute that gives us our habeas jurisdiction, we should exercise exceptional habeas jurisdiction in this case because of these circumstances that the Court of Criminal Appeals is just not doing their duty.
You have the availability of discovery sanctions in this case, I take it, because Mr. Reese is a party?
Yes, Your Honor.
But those aren't adequate.
Well, Your Honor, the question, I'm not here defending whether this relief makes the real party in interest whole. I'm defending the court's decision. I mean, sanctions would be a remedy.
You ask for the trial. You mean the trial court's decision?
As this was a show cause order on the trial court's own motion, the way it proceeded was there was a motion for sanctions, and after the evidence was being put on, the trial court adjourned the proceedings and said, I'm going to issue a show cause order for why this shouldn't be contempt.
But then there was a vigorous argument by the plaintiffs in the case saying that it should be punished as contempt.
Well, we certainly advocated for the court when she held the contempt proceeding, absolutely. But
what I'm wondering is why isn't the availability of discovery sanctions enough? I mean, you could default the defendant, that you would get all the relief you in asking for in the lawsuit.
And that's an excellent point, Your Honor, because you're asking about why wouldn't sanctions make the real party in interest hold, and I think an earlier question in the relator's argument was, why doesn't criminal conviction give the justice for Mr. Reese's perjury? And this case is a good example of why that doesn't work. The trial court has to have the ability to make its proceedings run and make people abide both truthfully and fully with those proceedings. Because
isn't there a due process issue, though, when you convict someone of a crime without a charging instrument, without a... they're entitled to a trial by jury on this. If you're going to convict someone of a crime, don't we have a huge due process issue with what the court did that goes beyond the argument you were just making about ensuring that the proceedings in the trial court are orderly?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree that there's a due process issue in this respect. And I want to answer that question. I do want to finish that last thought, which is there are other parties to this proceeding. So whether Mr. Reese gets criminal punishment by perjury or whether SB International gets sanctions that relieve it of the attorney's fees it's undergone, that proceeding doesn't go along without those other parties, and you can't make, the trial court needs the ability to force Mr. Reese to participate fully and truthfully in those proceedings, and this power is the only way to do it. And to answer your question, Justice Guzman, due process has been found by the U.S. Supreme Court, basically direct or indirect. And that's a conception that the Relator's Counsel confuses with the power of the contempt court. Basically, the reason that direct and indirect contempt concepts came up is to decide what level of due process ought to be afforded the contemnor. With regard to direct contempt—
But we have no order here, though. I mean, do you have this general blanket order to tell the truth? In general, I suppose. I mean, it's not an order, again, but it seems like that's what you're arguing, is that there's some—
There is no order.
Right, so—
Absolutely, and that's why this is criminal contempt, not civil contempt.
Is it, it's criminal, is it contempt of court or just contempt? What's the, I mean, I always thought of the phrase as contempt of court, which would suggest there would be a court order that the party abused in some respect.
Well, Your Honor, the Texas jurisprudence has never limited contempt of court to court orders. In fact, it's—
So then contempt is any time a party in any case lies?
Well, it's been
punishable by jail?
Your Honor, it's been found as disobedience. Certainly part of that has been disobedience with court orders and decrees. The other part of that has been, in general, disobedience and impeding, embarrassing, obstructing the course of justice.
Perjury has no— does it have to be on a material matter for perjury to be at issue?
Well, that's an interesting point. That's never been addressed by a Texas court. Certainly materiality is a element of perjury as the criminal charge. In this case, the focus of it is— in this case, there's no dispute over the materiality.
What I'm wondering about is, it sure would give you the upper hand if you could go through depositions in a big case, and there's always, you know, you're going to find some pretty blatant inconsistencies, or you often do, in testimony in a deposition versus in a hearing. And if that gives rise to the kind of contempt powers that we're talking about here, then, you know, courts are going to be involved in this business quite a bit more often than they have been, at least in the past.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that it's going to go that far. I mean, the courts have had this power of contempt fairly general. There's no case that the Relator cites where this is found not to be within the power, and they rarely exercise it. At least five members of this court have been trial court judges, and contempt power is exercised cautiously, and in this case, it's not just that Mr. Reese lied in a deposition. By his own admission, he lied in an injunction proceeding. There were three motions for sanctions, four motions to compel, until ultimately the truth was brought forth. And there's no dispute on the other side that he obstructed justice, which gets sort of to their point about, well, the court could enact this new rule or this new rule or this new rule. Well, there's no dispute that we don't need to figure out whether or not you need obstruction, because obstruction was found by the trial.
There are a lot of discovery disputes.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Very serious ones.
And
I can't fathom that counsel wouldn't argue if they could. Not only should you sanction the offender, but you should also commit him to jail because he lied, didn't produce documents, withheld documents, told us he didn't have any more. The list would just go on and on and on. If sanctions has been a problem for the last 30 years, why wouldn't contempt be?
Well, Your Honor, I think that they try to draw an artificial distinction and put it outside the court in a deposition. But as we know, under the Texas rules, that's the same as trial testimony. If I came to this court and said—
But what I'm trying to get you to look at, though, is there are lots of depositions taken in this state.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there are a lot of people who think that the witness wasn't telling the truth.
Yes,
why
sir.
Shouldn't those result in contempt hearings?
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is those don't result in contempt hearings because you don't have the particularly exceptional circumstances you have here.
So if he lies twice or five times or in two depositions, or I mean, where's the end of it? I'm just wondering how much is contempt going to inject itself into discovery?
Well, lying under oath, if that is a problem, then it's clear that the criminal courts and perjury are not taking care of it independent of that. And I wouldn't suggest that because people lie under oath, we should just accept that. Part of
the contempt. No, but why don't you go to the district attorney and press charges?
Well, it's an interesting point that they can do that, but that does, goes back to your earlier question, which is that doesn't remedy what the trial court is trying to do. It's not just I'm going to punish someone for lying in a particular instance, but I'm going to punish someone for obstructing a proceeding, for preventing an injunction from being entered by lies under oath, for going through several motions for sanctions and compel, and ultimately obstructing justice in that court. I mean, the court found very exceptional circumstances in this case, not a simple, well, in the deposition, he said red, now you have a document that says green. It's not that simple. She found, which uncontested, that he impeded and obstructed justice.
He said he wasn't involved in some transactions, and it turns out he was. That seems pretty routine to me.
Well, Your Honor, to put some gloss on that, in fact, there were three salespeople. One individual, before the same judge, had already been enjoined, and he was enjoined from talking with Mr. Reese, who was still working for the company and thought to be a loyal employee, and that's who he was talking to, was the person who was under an injunction, and the way we found out was through a private investigator who surveilled them, and then he came back and lied again in his deposition and the injunction proceedings. So it's not just a matter of he said a lie in a deposition, we're gonna prove that up and have a whole contempt to be a cottage industry. It's a matter of very exceptional circumstances in this case.
Does it matter that he also admitted during the proceeding that he did lie?
I think that it matters in the sense that he's now has no substantive challenge. He's not saying, well, there's some confusion, there's some ambiguity, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. He admitted not only just to lying in a deposition, but lying in an injunction proceeding. And if I came to this court, I mean, the order is phrased lying in a deposition, but there's uncontested testimony by him that he lied in the injunction proceeding before the court. There is unchallenged authority out there that that's a direct contempt. The judge could summarily throw him in jail for that. That's the power within the court. They want you to create an artificial distinction that, well, because it's in a deposition, it's okay to lie. That should be part of the contempt power. But think how artificial that would be under the Texas rules, where deposition testimony can be played in court. So let me ask this question. I'm not asking the questions. we played that deposition excerpt before the court at the hearing. Does that mean it comes within the power? They're trying to draw a line for direct and indirect and in court and out of court, and they're suggesting that a power that's been around for since before this country was created ought to be cut forth. Now, excuse me, ought
if
to be
he
cut
were,
down.
If he were charged with perjury and arraigned, and the judge says, how do you plead? He says, not guilty. And the judge says, well, did you lie? And he says, yeah, I lied, but I'm pleading not guilty. The judge couldn't sentence him.
Well, that's an interesting point. He's not entitled to a jury for a petty offense like this. So he wouldn't necessarily be entitled to a jury.
In perjury.
In less than 6 months, the Constitution doesn't give you the constitutional
right.
No, I'm
saying he's charged with perjury as a crime.
All right.
The crime of perjury. And he's not entitled to a jury.
Well, in the criminal context, I'd have to say he's not. I don't know the exact criminal rule on that point. What I would say is constitutionally, for a charge of less than 6 months, he would not be entitled to jury. But if perjury is a year, then he could be entitled to a jury.
That's contempt. That's not perjury, is it?
Right. But the perjury in the situation he's given me.
Perjury.
Right.
You're
contempt.
Talking about contempt.
Right. And the constitutional limit, or excuse me, that's the limit on contempt. And I believe the Constitution is coexistent with that, that you don't get a right to a jury.
The point is that if somebody lies and the prosecutor brings charges, the person is and information is filed and brought before the court and arraigned and so forth, and a trial date is set, and it gets a jury if he wants one, wouldn't you say?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the last part.
He gets a jury if he wants one under those conditions.
On those conditions, he would.
Sure. And if it turns out that the prosecutors are wrong and the charging is wrong and he wants to appeal it, he can appeal it.
That's true.
And so in this case, you say there's no appeal.
No, I'm not saying there's no appeal. In fact,
well, what's the remedy?
He has the remedy in the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals.
They turned it down. They won't
okay.
Hear it.
And if he doesn't have that remedy, he can do like many prisoners who are incarcerated. Once you exhaust your habeas remedies in the state courts, you can go to a federal district court. I don't believe that's warranted in this case, because one thing we haven't talked about, I don't think Relator's counsel mentioned at all, is there are no due process violations. And in fact, he affirmatively told the trial court, I understand these 2 points we're going forward on and didn't it specially accept to the others. Now, they've advocated the rule that special exceptions shouldn't be required, but that would be in contradiction to the court, the criminal rules. The rules of criminal procedure 1.14 require you to make objections to indictments, and technical objections are waived if you don't make them.
Let's assume a trial court is hearing an auto accident case, and one of the parties is rude. The tone is completely disrespectful. He issues an epithet to the judge, and the judge says, you're going to jail for, you know, until you can cool down. It's a civil case. What is that person's relief? It's not perjury. It's not violation of a criminal law. Is that person's relief habeas relief to a criminal court, or is it a civil case and mandamus is the issue about whether the trial court abused his or her discretion?
It would be habeas relief to this court or the Court of Appeals, because in the case you've described, cooling down, he's given him a condition. He's not, the distinction between civil contempt and criminal contempt is, are you punishing them for something they did, or you have a condition in which they have the keys to their cell?
I thought it had to be a violation of a court order.
If it was a violation of a court order, then this court has jurisdiction as
yes,
well.
Yes, but this is just, I'm mad because the person was violating protocol in court, was rude to the judge.
Then it would be a criminal contempt. And in fact, Henry Krupp's, the Court of Criminal Appeals, 1986, is a very good example of
that.
Does
that make sense to send all the, to say that this court has no mandamus jurisdiction to determine whether the trial court's conduct in a civil case was an abuse of discretion or not?
Well, Your Honor, whether it makes sense or not is, I respectfully submit, not a decision this court should make, because the Constitution gives limited, it says only habeas where provided by law. And in this case, the legislature has only provided it for orders, decrees, and judgments, not for other situations. And so this court would have to create its own jurisdiction.
Counsel, did I hear you say that you agree with opposing counsel that in a situation like this, the test ought to be whether the administration of justice has been obstructed?
Your Honor, I frankly said that we don't need to draw that line. I will point out the case I just mentioned, Henry Krupp's Court of Criminal Appeals, 1986, specifically said, unlike federal law, our law has not required that an actual obstruction of justice be present. There, they were punishing the failure to rise when the court came in, which was upheld. What I'm saying is we don't have to reach that issue in this case because the court found and is unchallenged that justice was obstructed.
Right.
So in conclusion, Your Honor, I guess I'm almost out of time.
You can conclude your argument.
What I would say is that last point, Justice Johnson, sort of makes the initial point, which is jurisdictional. In order to decide whether to adopt one of the several rules that the Relators Council put forward, you'd be examining Henry Krupp's and saying, well, does it really say that obstruction doesn't have to be an element or not, and potentially overruling the Court of Criminal Appeals? And I think that even though this court and certainly Relators Council in their brief think the situation is not right, that habeas should be divided in a different way, that's respectfully not for this court to decide. And so we'd ask that the court deny the mandamus petition.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Justice Medina, I think you pinpointed an important point with your question about whether there should be an order. And you said, under your example, if the trial judge said, look, plaintiff's counsel has told me that there's reason to believe that your client is lying in depositions, and the judge looked down and said, don't lie in any more depositions, then under those circumstances, if he lied in his deposition, he'd be violating a court order, and this court would, if he was held in contempt, punitive contempt, then this court would have, or the courts of appeals and this court would have habeas jurisdiction. Under Justice Jefferson's example, where the court is just angry with a party for contumacious behavior, that's a criminal contempt, the court wouldn't have habeas jurisdiction, even though it's a civil case. What opposing counsel is trying to do is sort of enshrine the mechanism, saying that the legislature and the Constitution made it very important that the mechanism be important, that it be habeas only, But I don't think that's true. There's no indication of that. This court saw that in 1960 in the Duramus case, where it says it's really not that important. It's a matter of past practice, but we can use our mandamus power. There's not a jurisdictional issue here. It's just a question of which power do we use, habeas or mandamus?
What if it's a criminal case and perjury and contempt and Court of Criminal Appeals denies relief? Can they come to this court?
No, if the court does so, I mean, if the court were
mandamus,
to say,
I'm saying.
If the Court of Criminal Appeals were to say, we don't have jurisdiction, maybe, but that's not going to happen. And I think that's the important point to take away from here is what the Court of Criminal Appeals was trying to do is saying, you guys handle civil cases, we handle criminal cases.
But in answer to the Chief Justice's question, if there were a violation of an order in a criminal case and the Court of Criminal Appeals wouldn't grant relief, this court could. We're not limited.
I think that's true. But
apropos your point, they should do criminal and we should do civil.
Right. And it all kind of, I think it traces back to a number of constitutional amendments, but if you look at the 1980 amendments to the Texas Constitution, that's when the legislature gave the courts of appeals jurisdiction over criminal cases. And if you look at the legislative history, the reason they did so is because the Court of Criminal Appeals was overwhelmed in its docket. It needed help. And so from then on, and then in 19, also that year, I guess it was 1980 also, this court got habeas jurisdiction. And so what's happening is the legislature, the people through the constitutional amendments, and the courts are just trying to say, we handle criminal cases across the hall, you handle civil cases. And contempt arising out of a civil case is a civil matter. It's not a criminal law matter, but even if it were, this court has mandamus jurisdiction.
What is the status of the case in the trial court?
The status of the case, it's still pending. I suspect there's discovery going forward and that sort of thing. Yes, my co-counsel nods me yes that the case is moving forward with discovery. And one last point I wanted, the opposing counsel said we do not dispute that there was an obstruction of justice. That was the second half of my argument. Of course we do. We say there was not the type of obstruction of justice that was called for in United States Supreme Court jurisprudence, the N. Ray Michael case and the Hudgings case. You know, what you have here is a lie, but no separate type of interruption of the business of the court system or the court, the trial.
Mr. Dennis, correct that your motion for rehearing across the hall mentioned you're seeking relief in this court?
I believe that's correct. We have not formally notified that court that we're here today, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this.